Thank you so much, Luca, for being in my podcast, Let's Tell Joe. You've been teaching and pitching and mentoring in several hackathons and events, Microsoft, Lean Startup Machine, Data Driven International Summit. So you've been in US at Silicon Valley. Yep. You spent quite a bit of time there, and you I guess you learned a lot from startups environment there. And welcome. Like, first of all, I want to give like a topic to the conversation. I've been working in a Foresight team in the last times, and so I wanna give it like a little bit of future touch to this. So I wanna brand it as the future of marketing and sales, because I think no one else than you, of the people I know, can really talk loud about that.
Well, thank you.
So how did it all started? Tell us a little bit more of when and how you entered the marketing and growth hacking then environment and industry.
Yeah, sure. Well, at the time I was in my, I think a few months into, let's say my core experience into the startup world, which was working for almost 2 years in this tech startup based in Rome and San Francisco. And so I was dealing with marketing. I started as like customer service and content marketing, and then I managed the whole marketing and also did a bit of fundraising on occasion. And so I was always looking for like new stuff, reading about marketing in American blogs. And I received from one of the co-founders, the CMO, so basically my boss at the time, Joya Pistola, a link to a Neil Patel article, which was actually more like a guide, an actual guide. It was called The Definitive Guide to Growth Hacking.
Yeah. And he's the most Googled, by the way. Patel is the, like, if you search for digital marketing on Google, he's the first one. It's like known for this.
But and he's super good at SEO. So that's all, there's also that. And I already knew Neil Patel because he writes awesome articles about marketing, very long copy, super useful stuff. I actually stopped reading Neil Patel's blog because when you read one of those articles, you just say, okay, I need to do this right now. And like you basically have no life because you spend all the time implementing his tips. That's how good he is. So I read that article, that Definitive Guide to Growth Hacking. I devoured it in like one day. And it made so much sense. It just made so much sense. I couldn't go back and do marketing as I was doing. So I think the main benefit is that it gave me a lot of structure, because especially if you do marketing, you're like overwhelmed by all the new stuff that's coming out. Now there's like artificial intelligence to improve advertising. There's augmented reality for local-based businesses and such. And you can't stay on top of everything. Also, you have case studies. So you like compare yourself to the competition. You read about new companies, competitors doing well, doing this and that. And you have this continuous impulse to like grab stuff and try to see it works. And it doesn't. And then you grab this other thing and you see if it works. And it's complete chaos. Because at the meantime, you also need to maintain all the existing channels and keep posting on social media once per day, create this long copy article. Then there's a new B2B customer. So let's do this custom slide presentation. And it's a mess. Because
very ramificated. So like content marketing and then more like strategic and direct marketing. So there are, obviously, that makes sense.
And also, especially when you work in technology, and in early stage startups, you often are sitting at the same table with designers or developers working on the product. What's silly at this point is that you're in the front line with your marketing, so you get all the customer feedback there is in forms of feature requests, complaint, bug fixing, mean comments on social media. But when you go back to developers and let's say the product team and you say, hey guys, I have data saying that people want this fixed or this implemented and so on, you rarely have the permission to give tasks to them.
Okay.
Because product is one thing, marketing is another thing. But what if marketing doesn't work because the product is shitty or incomplete or not that relevant for these people?
But that makes sense that marketing has like this broader view in and it shows how the product is actually doing apart from how people are buying it and then the metrics. It's about the product itself, the feedbacks that customers are giving.
Exactly. So I was stressed because I had data telling me we can go this far with marketing only, like with my area of operations. Yes. Yeah. Until if we want to go further, we need to bring the product also. So why am I working on one binary and the product is doing this other thing? And it made no sense. And finally, reading this book, I realized there was a methodology already existing. And it was 2014, so it was 4 years after the term was coined by Sean Ellis. And so I started digging and I realized there was a bit of literature about it, some case studies, the Airbnb article by Andrew Shen describing how Airbnb basically piggybacked over Craigslist. And I realized that this makes so much sense. And I totally approved this mindset and this way of seeing things and working focused on one metric at a time, but doing everything you can and everything that makes sense to solve that specific problem. Then you move on to a next one instead of managing content, analytics, app downloads, and customer support, and so on. And so I digged so much that after another year, I fired myself and basically became the first consultant and trainer on growth hacking in Italy. And of course, since no one knew what I was talking about, I had to do a lot of events and trainings and creating free content. So people...
I guess it has a big, massive benefit to be the first one. I like to use this term, like a knowledge trader.
Yeah.
Because you took the knowledge of another country, of another industry. Of
yeah, in a way, yeah.
And you took back home. And and so you were the first of something. And I guess that had huge benefits.
Yes, because when you are the first, you are also the best one automatically.
Yeah.
And you are the only one and the best one. But of course, it's also your job to educate the market. Because at day one, you have zero clients. Because no one knows what the fuck are you selling. Mm-hmm. So first you need to teach them and then you can sell them. And that's what I did. I was like an evangelist of this methodology. And after a while, other people came up. And that's why. So on one end, it was working and it was helping me. And on the other end, that's also true what you said. It was a blue ocean in Italy at the time.
I have a question. Do you think there is, maybe the best way to phrase this is, what did you find most difficult in Italy compared to US? Maybe like in further stages, like after years, after you've been in Silicon Valley, like what is the stress you had most, like the thing that really you couldn't manage that was in Italy compared to US, and maybe what was instead a better part if there is compared to US and Italy, like because you know I like every like who follow us knows I'm Italian as well, so I want to know about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say I think in general as Europeans, even in business, we are more conservative.
Okay.
And this can vary also in different countries and in different areas of Italy, for example. So if you go, in Italy, everyone knows in Northern Italy, they're more business-like as a mindset. They're more productive. And they...
Well, in Sicily, we are productive. You know I'm a Sicilian, I know about the South.
I know.
But yeah, surely we know that the North is more... business focused and finance focused. Probably it's thanks to Florence back to back to the times.
Oh yeah, and also probably their closeness to your Europe and an international landscape. So, but what happened is that it doesn't always happen, of course. But when you're talking to like a Northern Italy entrepreneur, if you say to them, if you give me 10 euro, I will make you earn 12, is like, that's it, I'm in. Cool. Yeah. Here's 10,000, so you can give me back 12,000.
Yeah.
if you use the same sales pitch in Rome or in Southern Italy,
it won't be the same thing.
No, it will be, but I don't trust you. It doesn't make sense. Yeah. How it does not make sense? You give me 10, you get back 12, 15. That's I wish someone told that to me, so I could say, yes, shut up and take all my money. But it doesn't work somehow.
But I know you have a policy in... wait a second. I have the light going on and off because this is a training room. So I know you have a policy in your company in 247X that if you don't make results, you don't get paid. But yeah. I also seen in the last growth conference that it's 100% the conversion rate. Or did it happen that... that you couldn't manage to get results to a client or something?
Well, the 100% conversion rate from yes to lead to customer, it's because we filter a lot. So we are actually able, we have a process enabling us to spot those kind of conversations like, I don't really believe you. So they don't even get a chance to become our customer. Mm-hmm. And actually today I was mentoring one of the founders of a company that we basically acquired in a way, because he uses our same sales process, and he's about to say to a client, no, we can't go on because there's a misalignment in our values, in our methodology. So okay. We don't think we could satisfy your need and send you an invoice and start working together, but this misalignment we're feeling today will only get bigger when you're investing advertising money, when you're paying us, and when we are dealing with the real market with unpredictable stuff that might happen, and experiments are going to fail. So let's just stop right here, and we're going to give you back our money. So the reason why we never found ourselves in the situation to give people money back is because first, there are a lot of ways to provide value when you're standing on the ground. So for example, if we are close to getting results, or if it makes sense, we might give you one extra sprint for free, which is 14 days of work hours. So it's like we didn't get results yet, but it's on us, so we'll give you extra 14 days on us. And also, if you realize there's this mismatch concerning culture, values, and so on, you will be the first one to say, I will give you back your money because I don't think it's a great idea to go on together.
Right. Speaking about values and sprints, which in the same video I was talking before, realized this sprint framework, which I've been using unconsciously, but not so structured, let's say. So thank you for sharing that in that video, because it's going to be very helpful. I wanted to talk about, do you have any public organization or government clients? Because right now there is a lot about digital transformation in the public sector, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And I see that there is some policy. For there's new policy for technology, and obviously in the future it will be necessary for the advent of blockchain and AI and robotics. So what do you think, maybe from a marketing or from a growth perspective, first of all, if you have any clients in that area, and what do you think might be the next or the future trends regarding the industry in that specific sector? Mm-hmm.
Well, we do not have, as an agency, clients in the public or government sector, but I did when I was consulting. I worked for 2 years to a European project, also that was dedicated to startup, was about promoting the entrepreneurial ecosystem in 4 cities in Europe, and one of them was Rome. And what I think about that kind of industry is that it's very tough because it's not performance based.
Okay.
It's about relationships. So, I mean, if you have the skills on how to build a funnel and bring traffic, optimize it and convert it and generate sales, no one will tell you, no, you're not good enough. It will in the public sector. They don't care about performance. They care about relationships. So it's very tough because you can do business if you manage to have the right people saying, yes, you can do that. But the reason why they say this yes, mm-hmm. it's not that if you're the best one on the market or offering the best price. And so it's a lot more like...
Time-consuming, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. But it is time-consuming because it's about lobbying and politics rather than being good at what you do. With data that say are saying this objectively, and also the other reason why it's tough, it's because there is let's say price factor in the public industry, and so they actually care about money, of course, about how much you're worth and how much you're asking, and they oftentimes reason like, we need to go to the moon, let's buy the cheapest shuttle ever. So it's like, if we fail, we fucking die. Is it clear? Sure. Let's buy the cheapest shuttle ever. So right. I don't like
I
that.
I think the topic is clear. While you were... another question. So we move forward. Huh? You were speaking about... before. I mean, you are so connected with the startup industry. And one thing that I wanted to ask you is, what's your opinion on co-working spaces? What do you think that makes a co-working space successful, and your like quick opinion on WeWork?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think co-working spaces makes a lot of sense, especially for startups, because even there it's, you need every player, every actor in the ecosystem to root for you if you want to make it. So you need to have investors on board. You need to have your team on board. You need to have advisors and mentors, which are so valuable. And you also need to have the market, your customers, and maybe in many cases, corporate partners on board. So we've seen that thanks to digital transformation trends, a lot of big companies are investing in digital transformation and open innovation. So they look at startups with different eyes and they are happy to work with them and create partnerships. And that could be a huge way to leverage the market for a startup. So even if you're a startup, you need connections, and you can create those connections pretty quickly if you're in a co-working space. On the other end, the co-working space is supposed to bring those connections to you. So I think the entrepreneur part of the thing is, put yourself in an ecosystem where you can grow your network. And on the other hand, a co-working space to be successful should actively try to create these opportunities for contamination. So bring a lot of interesting people to give speeches and lectures, create networking opportunities, because I also see co-workings that are full of talented and interesting people, and they never fucking talk to each other. And I am.
That's not good, I guess.
Yeah, that's not good. But in the end, it's on the co-working. If I am there 9 to 5 p.m. and I'm not creating more connections, so because everyone is heads down on their keyboard working, and that's fine. That's how it is supposed to be. But if you just create an happy hour or an event or a way to actively network, you will have, I guess, much more satisfied clients, because they will say, hey, I met a lot of cool guys in there, so I'm going to stay in this co-working office.
And then maybe that relationship, like that event, will make the relationship that will eventually like end up in having more connections while they are still
present.
Right.
Absolutely.
So that's an interesting part. So I've been recently nominated brand ambassador of a co-working space in my own town, which is where you don't really expect to have a co-working space, but in the area We are well known, and we are still building the brand and the business model as well. So what do you recommend? Like you mentioned corporate partners, which I think that like I see that a lot here in London, that every business has strategic partners with other business, which has strategic partner with other business, with, and so on and so forth. So there is this network of like sharing value and money possibly that that can really build up a business. So what would you recommend? Like what, like few tips if you want to say to a new co-working space in an area which you know that the idea of open innovation and creativity and technology and entrepreneurship in general is still at his at the seed level.
Sure. Well, I think I've seen also different co-working spaces in Italy, in cities you wouldn't expect to find a co-working space, like Siena, maybe. Okay. And
we are
I think,
by the way, the name is Makeup.
Okay. And I think other than startups and entrepreneurs and other kind of character that makes sense in a co-working space is creatives. So video makers, graphic designers, web designers, artists also. So I will go there because in order to create the aforementioned contamination, it is not only vertical contamination. So you do business, you have some senior businessman came in to give a lecture, but it's also horizontal. So I do business and today there's a video maker explaining how to do content marketing. And then there's a graphic designer, then there's a UX specialist. So that's also very interesting. So I will find a way to space in the way the co-working space creates connections and provide content, not only vertically. So like saying like, to companies.
Having this different approaches to how you build products and services. Yeah, yes. So can you still answer that question regarding WeWork, like quickly? Then I have another thing I want to really ask you.
Oh, yeah. Well, apparently, of course, they're doing another job at what they're doing. What I still think is that co-working spaces are as a business model, it's very hard to grow. And I also think, if I'm not mistaken, the main big players worldwide are now WeWork and Talent Garden, the huge chains of big chains of co-working spaces. But still, to make money out of co-working spaces to maximize profit, you also need to get into the training industry because whenever you have an empty room, you're leaving money on the table. You're losing money, and it's so hard to keep every room filled up. Because you would have, if you go to big cities, you would have a lot of market, but it's also saturated by other co-working spaces.
And the expenses will be higher as well.
Yeah, exactly. And if you go in a small city, you have no market, but it's a blue ocean. So you get all there is in that specific area. So reason why co-working spaces, it's super hard. It's a local business at the end of the day. When a company grows, it goes away. It buys a fucking office for themselves. So you have a customer life cycle based on the life of the single company or professional.
But do you think they should take any equity in the case they are doing like a specific mentorship or a kind of training as you were mentioning? Then I want to ask you, the next question is about training anyways.
You mean like the speakers coming in on the mentors?
Yeah, I mean, I know like the incubator somehow, like I've heard of HEX in Shenzhen that they are, I don't know if you know them, they are hardware based and they, and like compared to UK, they help people build products and robotics in like a couple of days compared to months in here. So, and they take like 5-10% equity. Do you think this model could work for a co-working space / incubator?
Yes, it might make sense as long as you're providing a service. So shares are a market good. They are worth money. So since an early stage startup can't afford to pay 20K of consultancy, they pay the equivalent of 20K in shares. The real question is it worth it? Is it worth 20K? Because if it is, of course I'm going to pay for it. You're going to mentor me. you're going to avoid me making a lot of mistakes. You're going to speed my go-to-market. So that's value. That's something probably the same guy have other clients paying for it. So it makes sense. But of course, if you're giving up that sum in equity, you should get return for that sum in services or other kind of benefits. Yeah.
Right. Thank you so much. I want to ask you now something regarding training, which you mentioned. So there is this new trend and in education, really, where everyone is realizing that there is really an opportunity because there is a lack of innovation in the education system. And we're not speaking about necessarily Italy or UK or US, but in general, most of the countries are having troubles with the performance of their students, and some key data, like from US, says that only 20% of the new graduates use really their graduation course, their degrees, and so like we know also that there is an online training revolution which is happening already, and it's worth billions of dollars worldwide. And so I want to ask you, do you already have an online course first? Second, what would you recommend to focus on, like when you want to build one? And maybe like some key tips on how to market it with a growth hacking approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have many online courses. I have like three, but one is a masterclass, so it's a composition of different courses. And I'm about to launch a new one. It should be out before the end of the year. So I will be marketing it, of course. And I think what I will focus on, what I do focus on when I create one, is first start from what's already there. So the best competitive edge you might have is having the best content out there. So either you go deeper or you go broader, or everything is about a specific use case, or you have extra tips that no one is talking about. So what I would do is first look on the main platforms to buy courses online, like Udemy.com or Coursera, and read the course's syllabus. So even without paying, you have a way to reverse engineer what they're talking about, and create like a perfect synthesis of that syllabus and add on stuff that no one is addressing. And the way you get ideas about it is oftentimes those courses are about technological stuff, so digital marketing. And everything changes every month in digital marketing. So if they created a course on Facebook ads last month, they probably aren't talking about artificial intelligence and CBO right now. So do that plus this other thing. And another way you can get ideas about it is by reading reviews of existing courses. In the best reviews and the worst reviews, you will find people saying, yeah, I kind of liked it, but I would have liked a bit more of that. Cool, do a bit more of that. The Amazing. Market is saying we want this. So then you work on your content, and then to launch it and marketing, what I would do is do not focus on the launch itself or on the course itself, if it's your main product you're selling, but try to build a list first. So create like take the first lesson, break it down in 4 videos and give them away for free in exchange for someone's email, or pay for someone to transcribe the audio of the course, create some content, or like a 10 lesson email course about the same topic. So first you get a list, and then you can launch the course to a queue of people already waiting for it. So you will have reviews from day one, paying user from day one, a way to get referrals and comments on how to improve from this first community of people. And you never have this basically empty store syndrome of we're launched, we are here, zero visits, zero conversions.
Yeah.
Zero
so the another thing that I learned from you possibly and then grow hugging is that you need to sell before you actually build the product.
Yeah.
So that's probably a way. So do you think like one should create different topics? Like, is it better on a marketing perspective or from the consumer perspective to have multiple courses when they're out to buy? Or like one should focus only on one topic? Like, for example, I don't have an online course, but I want to build one. And I've seen from other courses that I bought that kind of gives an authority when you see that that specific person where you bought the first one or where you want to buy it has multiple courses. So do you think it's better to have multiple in different areas, or maybe like break that one in three parts and three courses, or just like it's okay to have just one and focus on that?
Well, one way to answer that is format. So if you had to create an online course that's 18 hours long, you will probably have the problem of making people feel overwhelmed by the amount of hours they need to see to it. Because when people buy the course, they are already
having money. I can hear you. 1 second, I can hear you. You have a technical problem. Right. Sorry, I didn't hear the last three minutes.
I was saying...
I'm currently in my university library, so the speaker was just speaking. So. Right.
Yeah, so I was saying one point is format. So if you had to do like an 18 hours long course, you would have the problem of having people feeling overwhelmed by the amount of hours. So they wouldn't easily see themselves going through it 100%. So they wouldn't buy it. And that's why most courses are like 2 to 3 hours long, even shorter. And they are broken down into 2, 3, maybe 5 minute segments, not more. Because you need to tune yourself with the people's attention and also with their expectation to buy something and go through it. If it's too long, they will say, oh, I will never do 100% of it, so I'm not buying. And then the second thing is positioning. So on to creating an online course, it's like a huge signal saying to the market, I'm an authority on this. I'm an expert. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to do a course. So it might be an interesting move to quickly position yourself in something, saying, I'm an expert of this domain. So if you want to do that in multiple niches, you might as well create different courses. So for example, I have some on growth hacking and some on productivity and time management.
Yeah.
And the next one is going to be about B2B LinkedIn marketing. So very specific things. And of course, it would make sense to do a course about growth hacking, time management, and B2B marketing, because they're entirely different things. But if you do, also make sure that they are different enough so that you don't have overlaps. Mm-hmm. And so for example, I actually did that mistake. So I always work with partners in creating these courses. So existing platforms, existing communities. And I have one online course with some guys on growth hacking and e-commerce and also and performance marketing, and also another one on growth hacking. And to this day, they went out like 2 years ago. And to this day, I still get people messaging me and saying, hey, Luca, I wanted to buy your course, but which one should I buy? Because they don't get it. And it's not their fault. They're not positioned different. There are differences, of course. One is dedicated to marketing professionals and agencies. So it's very much on a higher part of the funnel, traffic and conversions and that stuff. And the other one is more entrepreneurial. So it's about, I have an idea, I want to create a new business. That's how you go from step 0 to 100 using growth hacking. So they are very different, but they are not communicated different enough. So people don't get it.
Right. That's a very good point, I think. It's like you need to differentiate who you're selling what.
Yeah. Yeah. Even against yourself, you definitely do.
Right. That's really, really good point. About... productivity. What do you think that, like, I know you mentioned that your mentor, which actually I had the chance to have a quick call like 1 year ago or something before I was getting my first client here in London. He gave me like a good tip in that moment, which he catched me with the funnel, with the free call. And but yeah, anyways, he like you mentioned that he gave you this tip of using the chronometer or the timer, which I do sometimes, for example, when I need to meditate. Like the one thing that I learned, which helps me productivity, to be more productive, is like to meditate 10 minutes. Like literally, it's hard the first times. Then you just like sit and like really empty your mind for 10 minutes. It sounds the timer, and then you are like focused like a train on its line. But like, what would you recommend more about this?
Well, the first thing I would do is first it's like in growth hacking or whenever you want to improve something, which in this case is doing more with less time. You need to, like, if you want to go on a diet, first thing, you need to weigh yourself. So if you don't have a quantifiable assessment of your starting situation, there's no improvement because you don't have visibility on anything, not quantitative or qualitative. So first thing first, I will get an agenda and every day note down every task that you do that you've been doing that day. Awesome. Awesome. And so you can then realize if there's some stuff that you can delegate, some stuff there's just a distraction, so you need to eliminate, some stuff that is urgent but non-important, mm-hmm. or stuff that is maybe not urgent but important. Because what I also realized, and I noticed this when I was working in a team, also in the startup, is that if you don't have such processes to discriminate these kind of tasks, you will always feel that the last thing coming out is always the most important. So urgent is more important than important. And that's so not fucking true. So it's crucial to discriminate between what's important and what's urgent, because these two variables, these two things are very different. So it's, for example, I'm working on the quarterly growth financial plan for our company, determining how much client we need, our costs, so it's super important because it will influence the next 4 months. But then I get an email and like some journalist is pushing me to send them back the interview. And that's the last thing coming out, interrupt me. So it's, oh fuck, it's very urgent. They want the interview by tonight, I might not make it. So this is urgent, but it's not important. I should keep fucking work on the growth plan and fuck the journalist, I'm sorry. You're not top priority for my goal.
Which so is important that it comes before urgent.
Yeah.
But if urgent is also important, urgent and important come
well,
first.
Sure. Okay. That's why it's a matrix. So yeah. It's like you have urgent, non-urgent, important, non-important. You can distribute the task over this matrix and then act on it.
So, is that metric on the Luca content pack? Because yeah, you know I had the Luca content pack. Maybe.
It might be like the it's called the Eisenhower Matrix.
Eisenhower Matrix. Check it out.
It's also in the free course about productivity on lacerba.io. It's like at the end of the 1 hour course, there's this.
Okay, amazing. So I want to ask you a couple of things as we're almost running out of time, but one thing that, like, personally, I'm finding, struggling, and I don't fear saying it, publicly and sharing it, is that, attracting the right people when it comes to, building a team, and so, which is, like, fundamental to scale your business, which, you know, I'm currently working as a digital marketer, and there is a lot of focus on content marketing, which, obviously, it's a time-consuming process, and that's why I'm also trying to build something more scalable as a digital product. But I think that even in that case, I will always want to keep that kind of do-it-for-you services because I enjoy doing it. So, but I see that to perform the best, I really need someone else to deal with the standards operations, and I find myself like. Not necessarily like struggling, but but sometimes I would need someone else like to help me out, so more people to help me. Others instead, I found that I can manage everything. So, what do you recommend like in these cases, and how to build the team, how to build your tribe somehow? Like maybe you can tell me the story of 247 pair.
Yeah, well, I think, especially if you are looking for co-founders and not employees, so it's about building stuff as equals and becoming part of the project and not working for the project, because in that case, just the salary plays a big, pretty big part. You need to have something more, something different than money to offer, because probably it will not be about money, more about shares and so on. And the point is, you usually what you need to offer that's not money, it's a very, very strong mission and vision that someone that the candidate co-founder identifies with. So the way you do that is by not building stuff that's 100% yourself. So for example, of course, Tony Robbins can do that. Tony Robbins has his own team and a bunch of people working for him. But before you get to Tony Robbins' level, it will be difficult to find people that are smart enough, and you want people that are very smart,
obviously,
that are willing to sacrifice working on their dreams and working to allow you to accomplish your dream. So what the fuck should I make Luca Barboni successful if I am not Luca Barboni? What's the point? And you're not giving me money. What's the point of being a part of the project? So it shouldn't be about your ego. It should be about something that's bigger than you. And thanks to the fact that it's bigger than you and other than you, even though you're very passionate about it, it can encompass other people. And
that's the case of the crowdfunding, obviously.
Yeah.
Or how about like in the case of employment, like if you need to employ someone, so finding the right person that you can collaborate and maybe like probably one of the reasons why I might find it more difficult is that I constantly travel, or I try to travel as much as I can. So it has to be like more like a virtual team. So then, I think that might be one of the challenges that one needs to overcome in order to manage everything. So what do you think like in that case?
Yeah, well, in terms of employees, there's the other side of the coin, which is company culture. So I suppose if you're looking for employees, you're already getting revenue. So if you have some money to invest to grow the team. And in that case, something that can inspire people. And I get, for example, we in our company have a very strong culture because we have seen a ton of shit. So we define who we are and who we are not, who we are going to work with. And I believe what really defines a culture is what is left out by that culture. So what you're not willing to allow and accept is what defines you and defines your culture and your company. So if you're just throwing marketing bullshit, like we are the leaders of the market, we are the number one best top company to work with, and that's clearly not true, that's not going to work. If you already say we are this, working with these specific tools for this specific market, with these specific customers in this specific area, you can have people say, oh, I'm from that area, super cool, I want to work with you. Or, oh, I love that tool and I know how to use it, so maybe I can be of some help. I would love to use it every day. That's my field of expertise. I want to work with you. But if you don't get specific, you will not trigger specific interests and motivations of people.
That makes completely sense.
So that's something mistaken. Brand positioning doesn't only work for customers and clients, people you sell to. It also works for the talents you attract. So it's your identity as a company. It works for customers. It works also for talents.
Right. I have one question which I also want to ask you. Like right now, I have I was actually negotiating with the startup as well, which already got founded and is already getting traction. But I found that they needed more help on the marketing perspective, and it's very clear. Like for example, they operate in the fashion industry, but it's connected with technology. So that's what really attracted me, because I also have a passion for fashion and technology. So I was like, whoa, I really want to help them. So it's even tangible that they need help, because if you send me an email, if the company sends me an email and you cannot see the text, or like you see that, you say, wow, wait a second. Like, so every person who receiving this email is seeing this, like, this is not really nice thing to see, like with your logo attached to it. So I tried to help, but and I'm in touch with the founder. And so, but after a few emails, even though we were finding like nice compromises in terms of delivering the results, and so not making it so much of a bet for them, but like finding like making a trial of 1 week so that we could show him that we are able to create these values, to provide this values, and to make the results happen. But after a while, like maybe because of my communication or for their own reason, but they didn't come back to us anymore. And I was trying to I'm following up, but nothing happens anymore. So like I think you know him, you know Stelly from close.
Oh yeah.
I think you shared a video of him, which is how I knew Close and Stelly, which I really love the philosophy of following up until they answer or say no. So right now I'm like finding myself following up every week and every week, but at the same time I feel like it might get worse and worse because they might think that I'm needy of getting them as a client, which obviously I want to get them as a client, but I really want to help. But I'm not sure if they're getting the same message I want to share. So, and even if they are reading my emails, really, and texts, because I'm sending, like we were talking on WhatsApp as well. So we were following on WhatsApp, which is actually something that I don't use to do with prospects. So like in this scenario, which I pictured you, what would you do to make the person say, okay, let's meet this guy and hire him as our marketing consultant? What would you do in this case?
Well, first I would make sure that, as you said, you're not giving the idea, I'm not giving the idea of being needy or of making them feel guilty for not answering back, because that's a huge mistake. And because basically people already feel guilty, they know you're waiting an answer from them. They already know this. And there's a reason for which they're not giving you an answer yet. And the reason probably is they're just busy as hell. And if you add weight on that guilt, they will never get you back. They will never solve that guilt because it's too much. And they start anticipating like the awkwardness of answering, like it was yesterday, but it was 2 months ago. So yeah. Like, you know what? You'll probably forget about it, and that's it. So first of all, make sure every time I get back to them with a follow-up, I'm adding extra value, like sending them a link of something cool I've read that might be useful to them or so on. But then to try to force them to decide, I will like create an offer they can refuse with a time frame.
Okay.
I'm not sure if this is your tactic of staying silent, but I've come to the decision that I really like what you're doing. And before I go to some of your competitors, because I love them too, apparently, like with this industry, I will like to give you the like my last chance.
Like and 15% on what we agreed initially.
Yeah, exactly. For X months as a trial, and then we do another contract. But I will be hurt if we don't start this collaboration, because I like your company, I like your team. I think there's a huge opportunity. So I will always, that's what I would do. I will always have this regret if I don't do whatever I can to try to collaborate. And
that's the last chance. Like
they yeah, say that's this offer will
so
say
making, that. Somehow making them feel guilty for not hiring me at the end, not for not answering.
Yeah, not guilty. It's more like FOMO, like fear of missing out on something that's precious. Okay. So it's right. Like it's still a risk for me, because I will give you a lot of time. And So it's a gamble, and if you want to take action on it, it will be valid until Monday. So if I don't hear you back until Monday, to me, it's done. You will never hear from me again. And I hope you do awesome business and grow even without me. Bye-bye.
Okay. Amazing. I will probably use that, and I will let you know how it went.
Okay, cool.
So we have the few last minutes, and I wanted to ask you something. What did you find more interesting or working with startups? So what has been the Google ads, like Facebook ads, LinkedIn ads? What do you think is working the most right now? And if there are some patterns that shows there's an industry is works more this kind of approach, or what's the trend right now? What's working most? And if there is a pattern between them?
There isn't. A lot of it depends first if they are B2B or B2C, then if they are product-based or they are a service, and then if the business model is e-commerce, SaaS, subscription-based, whatever, media-based. And so I think if you create a matrix between those variables, yeah, you will find some patterns within this niche. So B2B services with a subscription-based model, then there are patterns in there. But when you go broader, when you zoom out, you're lost. It's so very specific and different. And in general, what I think works most, like I've seen it the opposite way. Like I've seen promising startup stuck, not growing at all because they missed this thing. And this thing is language. So this is something that it's often overlooked in when you see graphics about lean startup, this is the growth curve of a startup. And it's called basically language market fit. So over there in the market, unless you're selling something that's super innovative or pure research, there are people already talking about your field of solutions, your industry, the kind of stuff you're selling, or at least the problem you're solving. And it's your job to intercept those conversations, be part of those conversations. But you will not be able to do that unless you're using the same exact same words they are using. So when I was in Silicon Valley, I was working with this AI startup that was a spin-off of the previous startup, the previous company. And it was B2B. It was an SDK to implement AI-based functionality without hours of development because everything was ready and within the technology in white label. And the way we were advertising ourselves, the main sentence of the website, the headline, the title on the landing page, the bio on social media, was presenting the product in a way that was completely different compared to what people were talking about AI and that stuff. So we were like a super hot thing. We were the coolest, but we were presenting ourselves in a totally different way. So people were not getting that we were doing that exact same stuff everyone was talking about. So basically, the point was we were stressing IoT integrations. We were stressing smart actions, triggers and action, if and do workflows. But what we were actually doing was enabling companies to build recommendation engines like Amazon and Netflix in no time with much less cost. And that's super fucking awesome. Unless you're saying it in a whole different way.
Right.
So the one of the most important stuff, you will see your conversion rates growing, your investors finally getting what the fuck you're doing once you nail this. And it's language market fit. And the way you figure out language market fit is by devouring every piece of content of your biggest competitors. The keywords they're using in the landing page, their manifesto blog posts on Medium. You study the language that people that are already there, they're already working well, are using. And then, of course, you contextualize within your market. And the way you do it is you brainstorm some hypotheses of UVP, value propositions, and then you test them with landing pages and Facebook ads just to get leads. And then you monitor where are you getting the most CTR, the higher CTR, the lowest CPC, and the lowest cost per lead, and the volume of how many leads you get with these different landing pages. And when you have a winner, you revise all the text on the website, all the text on the official landing pages with the fucking good keywords that are clicking in people's brain when they read them.
So even before testing the customers, testing the language, that's probably the best thing that you could have.
Well, of course, you test both of them, but it's very, very important.
Right. Thank you so much, Luca. We've seen you like going into the darkness.
Oh, yeah.
Probably you had, yeah. You had the natural light coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. I'll make a fast forward and send it to you. Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was great. A lot of content, a lot of value. I think that that's enough. Thank you so much for everything. And let's keep in touch.